I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Pack an overnight bag. That's Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy's advice to commuters making their way into New York City this week. Amtrak service is shut down between New Haven, Connecticut, and New York City after Friday's train collision and derailment that injured about 70 people. Amtrak officials aren't saying when things will get back to normal on the country's busiest rail corridor, but service is affected as far north as here in Boston, where people are scrambling to book buses. Ted Mann is a transportation reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And Ted, how bad was the commute this morning?
Well, we're hearing some reports about pretty heavy traffic in southwestern Connecticut, and there also are some reports of not particularly crowded trains, because those Metro-North trains that are running are not going the whole length of the New Haven Line route, and those passengers who might ordinarily board in Bridgeport are having to take another route to get into the city.
Ah, so they didn't even bother getting on the trains because they knew it wouldn't get them far.
Right. Well, I'm sure some did, some hardy souls, but there are plenty of others who are carpooling or driving themselves.
As we looked at video of the crash site, it was hard to believe there weren't more injuries. Would you remind us what happened and how bad the damage is?
Well, Friday evening, an eastbound train somehow derailed, and they're still trying to find that out, and wound up in the path of a westbound commuter train that sort of sideswiped it. They didn't hit quite head-on, which is a really lucky thing, because both trains were going about 70 miles an hour just before the crash. And we know at least 70 people were hurt, and there seemed to have been quite lucky that no one died.
Ted, as you know, covering transportation, Amtrak is under constant financial pressure. How much of a financial hit do you think the cost of this derailment will be to them?
They are not answering questions about that just yet, but certainly this is a big interruption for the most heavily traveled route that Amtrak runs. It's about 750,000 people a day on the whole Northeast Corridor. That would be a smaller segment between New York and Boston, but still a pretty significant hit to their revenue.
As bad as this rail accident was, you've written that it wouldn't have had such a big impact on commuters if it weren't for the very bad timing of a section of rail where this happened, undergoing right now an upgrade. How does that complicate the situation?
Right. It happened in one of the worst possible spots for this to happen, on the New Haven Line, which is the stretch of track between New York City and New Haven, Connecticut, which is operated by Metro-North, but on which Amtrak's trains run. They're upgrading the catenary wires, those overhead cables that power the trains, and as part of that project, which also involves replacing some bridges, they've had to take two of the four sets of tracks out of service. In this particular 7-mile stretch, it's down to only two tracks, and that's where the trains collided. What that meant was, because of the wreckage of the cars and also the damage done to the rails, there's no way to run a train through.
Whereas if they hadn't shut down the other two rails, they could have possibly switched to those rails.
Right. There would at least have been the possibility that you could have diverted trains around, and that's probably what Amtrak and what Metro-North also would be doing. So you'd have deeply affected service, but it wouldn't have been the total severance of the passageway right there.
We've read that when transportation officials made the decision to reduce that section of track from four lanes to two, they acknowledged that it created a vulnerability, you know, meaning not much of a backup plan if something went wrong. And it looks here like obviously the odds did not work out in their favor.
That's right. And the vulnerability, you know, they don't even necessarily mean catastrophe in that situation. It really lessens their flexibility to move multiple trains through this corridor. So they were already operating with essentially a handicap. And then if something terrible goes wrong, as it did on Friday, you're really in a pickle.
Is anyone questioning whether the rail reduction was a poor decision, or did it just have to be done at some point and the timing was not good?
You know, in this area, they're replacing bridges that are two tracks wide. So there's, according to the railroad, there's just really no alternative to that. You have to take both tracks out. The overall project is behind schedule, expensive, but I don't think there's anyone arguing that it's not necessary. They're replacing catenary wires, in some cases, that were hung in 1907 that are incredibly old. The structures are, you know, in really dilapidated condition. And when the project's complete, they'll be eliminating a major problem that's weather-related on this part of the tracks. And when it gets hot, the overhead power lines start to droop. It really affects the speed at which trains can go through. So when the project's over, the corridor will be in much better shape.
So overall, has this project raised even more questions about the infrastructure of our railways and the condition of that infrastructure?
You better believe it. I think the fact that some of this equipment has stayed in place for so long is in its, you know, just the fact that it's of that age suggests that we have not done the amount of infrastructure investment that a lot of people are saying we should. Whether this prompts people to meaning the government of Connecticut, Metro North, Amtrak, the federal government, to throw more money into making these projects go faster is an open question. But certainly there will be people calling for that.
The National Transportation Safety Board doesn't expect to have an official report on what happened for months. But in the meantime, briefly, any sense of when things might get back to normal?
By the end of this week, Metro North expects to have some degree of repair done and to be able to move trains through that section of affected track. But it's not clear that that means that those two tracks will be back to where they were on Friday morning. And I think probably into next week, you'll still see some limitation on service or some workarounds as both the railroads get back up to speed. But they say that they're trying to do as much as they can, as fast as possible, to restore everything.
That's Wall Street Journal transportation reporter Ted Mann. Ted, thank you.
Thank you.
The controversy over who knew what when the IRS targeted conservative political groups did not die down over the weekend. That's in large part because newspapers reported that 1 week before the news became public, the White House counsel's office knew that a damning report from the IRS inspector general was coming out, but didn't tell the White House chief of staff or President Obama. The president says he found out about the improper scrutiny at the same time the public did on May 10th. The political ramifications of this are still playing out in D.C., but we also want to get at the context. Why was the IRS scrutinizing these groups called 501c4s in the first place? 501c4s don't pay taxes and don't have to disclose their donors, and they are allowed to intervene in politics as long as their primary purpose is, quote-unquote, social welfare. So also in terms of context, what is the role of the IRS in regulating these so-called social welfare groups as well as organizations involved in politicking? Donald Tobin is with us. He's Associate Dean at Ohio University's Moritz College of Law. He's an expert on tax and campaign finance laws, and he joins us from a studio at OSU. Dean Tobin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Could you first give us a little primer on these 501c4s for people who really can't tell the numbers and the letters apart? What is that classification, and what are the advantages and disadvantages of being classified a 501c4?
So a 501c4 is a social welfare organization, and a social welfare organization needs to be formed to promote the social welfare of the country. And that could be engaging in the promotion in some way of the common good and general welfare of the people in the community. So it's a very, very broad standard. What's important for this situation is that they are allowed to engage in political advocacy. It's just that political advocacy can't be the primary purpose of the organization. And the reason this matters is that if political advocacy is the primary purpose of the organization, then it's a 527 political organization, and then it's required to disclose its donors.
What would be an example of the types of activities that a so-called social welfare organization does that make it unquestionably a social welfare organization and not one that's also delving in politics?
So these are usually organizations that are promoting an issue and along with promoting that issue might lobby for the issue and also maybe even do a little bit of politicking for the issue. So you might be an organization promoting gun rights where you wanted to promote guns, do safety courses, talk about why guns are great, but you also might want to lobby for guns or you might want to lobby for a particular candidate who supports gun rights. You see the same thing in the environmental area. So these are organizations that have educational missions, often partisan educational missions, or maybe, advocacy educational missions, but they're not engaged in intervening in a political campaign as their core function.
But I think your answer almost illustrates the problem, because what you described sounds quite political, but you're saying that that might be legitimate under the tax classification of 501c4.
It would be legitimate under the tax classification as a social welfare 501c4. We want to have a place where people can lobby and they can engage in political discourse. The key is if you're going to engage in candidate-type advocacy, if you're going to intervene in elections and engage in election advocacy, we want disclosure of who your donors are so that we have both an ability to understand it from a voter education standpoint, but also for a corruption standpoint. And so in 2000, Congress added disclosure provisions to political organizations. They didn't add them to social welfare organizations because intervening in a political campaign wasn't supposed to be the primary function.
But exactly what political advocacy is and how much political advocacy they're allowed to do, that's very vague.
It's very vague, and that's really what's at issue here. The IRS is responsible for determining whether or not an organization is primarily engaged in political advocacy. And so it needs to look at the facts and circumstances of what's happening in a particular group. Is it running campaign ads? But also, is it advocating for a candidate in publications? Or is it advocating for a candidate merely by the way it promotes issues in a very partisan way? So it's a very difficult standard to apply.
Yet that's the standard that the IRS has to apply. And, you know, we've heard people like Representative Jim McDermott, a Washington State Democrat, say that Congress was partly at fault for all of this, for not having given clear instructions about when politically active 501c4 organizations cross the line. He says the law is not clear. So is there an argument to be made that the IRS is having to make political judgments it's not qualified to do?
Well, this is a very difficult position for the IRS to be in general. And it has this role of having to police the political advocacy of tax-exempt organizations because the various tax exempt benefits depend on whether you're engaged in advocacy. So, for example, a charity is not allowed to engage in political intervention at all because we don't want our tax dollars to be subsidizing political activity.
These would be 501c3s, for example.
Correct. Charities, churches, hospitals, things like that. Our contributions to them are tax deductible. For social welfare organizations, they don't get that tax benefit. And so this is the role that the IRS has. And the problem is when you have a facts and circumstances test that attempts to look at all the different things that might be political, it requires some examination of the organization. Now, we could have a really bright line test. The problem historically is the brighter the line test, the more people use ways of manipulating what they say in order to avoid falling within the test.
By bright line, you just mean very, very clear, defined black and white definition.
Right. So in the election law context, we had this idea that you had to have express advocacy. You had to expressly advocate for a candidate. And then we saw these sham groups, which would form what we used to call sham issue advocacy. They'd pretend to be engaging in issue advocacy, but it would really be political. So you would run a commercial that says, you know, Senator X is the worst thing in the world. Senator X hates the country. Call Senator X and say you don't like what he's doing. And then they would say that's an issue ad. And so they were avoiding federal election law disclosure. And so disclosure was added to the Internal Revenue Code to require groups to disclose.
Disclosure of who their donors are.
Of who their donors, the donors to 501c4s. And what groups are trying to do here is avoid having to disclose. And by earning the classification as social welfare, they're avoiding the campaign disclosure that's required for political organizations. So that's really the underpinning of why we have this mess of the IRS having to get in and investigate and figure out whether an organization is political or not.
That's tax and election law expert Donald Tobin at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. We're talking with him about the IRS's targeting of conservative political groups and how the IRS ended up in that role. We'll have more with him after a break. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our look at the context of the IRS story. As we know, the agency disclosed that it's been giving extra scrutiny to Tea Party and other conservative groups seeking tax-exempt status. The head of the agency's tax-exempt division calls the actions absolutely inappropriate. Donald Tobin is Associate Dean at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, and he's an expert on tax and campaign finance laws. He's been explaining to us how the IRS came to be in the position of having to determine whether an organization is operating as a political group or a purely social welfare group. And Dean Tobin, it was the IRS's Cincinnati office where this extra scrutiny was happening. This is the office that deals with tax-exempt organizations. And agency leaders are saying that lower-level workers there are responsible for the targeting of conservative groups. Would you explain to us whether these local offices work largely independently or whether anything that went wrong was going to come out of that office because that's where tax-exempt work is done?
So the Cincinnati office is not a local IRS office. It is a huge part of the IRS infrastructure. So this isn't like a local IRS audit that's doing just your area's audits. This is a very large center that the IRS conducts a lot of its activities at. So the Cincinnati office really needs to be seen in that light, where there's a lot of employees doing a lot of work and a lot of screening. And in that context, you have a lot of line-level work. So you have a lot of people who are having to make decisions about what needs to be investigated and what doesn't, how to sort where you're going to put forward the agency's resources. When you have an agency like the IRS and you have thousands of applications coming in, there has to be some place where you do that kind of sorting. And that kind of sorting is not usually done at a very high level because there's just so much of it to be done. So you hope that the people are trained to do that sorting in an effective way.
The scale of the work that needed to be done seemed disproportionate to the staffing, something like 200 people processing 70,000 applications a year. Is that a lot to ask of 200 people?
Sure. And the problem is not just that they had to process these applications. It's that understanding what's happening in these applications is very time-consuming. As we discussed, when you're using a facts and circumstances test, when you're using a test that requires you to delve into what's actually happening, that requires more work. I mean, these organizations that are properly C4s, properly social welfare organizations, are putting forward their applications, and they're relatively easy. But if you're afraid that an organization is really a political organization but is masking itself as a social welfare organization, it takes a lot of effort to find out what the organization is really doing. And so that's why you had these questions that Congress found to be very invasive, and I think most Americans would find to be very invasive, and why you had such an amount of time that was necessary to investigate the organizations.
Right. We've heard about even these very small groups saying they felt buried in paperwork that seemed designed to paralyze their work or maybe just make them go away. But, you know, ultimately, if the IRS was trying to crack down on dubious social welfare organizations that were actually political organizations in disguise, basically, was the IRS doing a lousy job of that because it was focusing on these small organizations that were unlikely to have much political impact?
It doesn't seem that the enforcement in this area was done in a very effective way across the board. I think that you wonder why they weren't targeting organizations that were larger, why they weren't targeting organizations that were more actively involved. There clearly were lots of press reports about organizations that were questionable. And in fact, there had been complaints filed with the IRS about certain organizations.
The point you make about larger organizations was made by a Bloomberg writer, Paul Barrett, who says, you know, what about Crossroads GPS, the Karl Rove organization, or the Obama-affiliated Priorities USA Action? They spent hundreds of millions of dollars of political advertising, much of it harvested from secret donors, and they don't seem to have been the targets of this effort.
Well, that raises a second question or problem, which is that because of taxpayer privacy laws, we don't actually know what's happened. We don't know if Priorities USA or other organizations have been looked into by the IRS because we're not, as a public, informed about who's investigated and what the findings were of those investigations.
So they may also have been blitzed with paperwork, but maybe they were just larger and more able to field it.
We have no idea whether or not some of these larger organizations were asked these questions or whether they were also more sophisticated and able to push back. We have a sense that these things often become public, and so the groups might have released to the public on their own that they were under investigation. But we have no real evidence one way or another of what organizations were examined and what weren't.
You know, for years, the argument's been made that the tax code can be abused, particularly in the case of 501c4s. If the IRS had just been more even-handed in its targeting, not just of conservative groups, but also of left-leaning liberal groups, do you think that this scandal would not be a scandal?
I hope it wouldn't be a scandal, because we really needed enforcement of this by the IRS. I mean, if you allow organizations to avoid the law by pretending to be another organization, then that's really detrimental to how we're going to enforce the law and how we're going to operate. What's problematic here, obviously, is that that enforcement mechanism needs to be done in a neutral and fair way, and it doesn't appear to have been done that way in this case.
Donald Tobin is Associate Dean at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Dean Tobin, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
other news we're watching today, Yahoo is buying the online blogging platform Tumblr for $1.1 billion. It's seen as a move by CEO Marissa Meyer to try to rejuvenate Yahoo. Yahoo said that David Karp, a high school dropout who started Tumblr 6 years ago, will remain in control of the service in an effort to retain the same, quote, irreverence, wit, and commitment to empower creators. Also, the Brookings Institution released a study today that says those in poverty living in the suburbs jumped 67% between 2000 and 2011. But suburbs still have a smaller percentage of their populations living in poverty than cities do. And United Airlines is getting its Boeing 787s back in the air. The planes are flying again after having been grounded for 4 months because of battery issues on 787s owned by other airlines. Federal authorities lifted the grounding order about a month ago, but it's taking Boeing and the airlines a few more weeks to fix most of them. Still ahead today, the climbing season on Mount Everest has been marred by a fight between trekkers and their guides. A longtime Everest climber tells us he isn't surprised. He calls the mountain a powder keg of conflicts. News is next, here and now. In northern Afghanistan today, a suicide bomber dressed in a police uniform killed 14 people, including a prominent provincial council chief. The Taliban quickly claimed responsibility. It's been trying to weaken the Afghan government with attacks and assassinations aimed at intimidating officials and civilians in the lead-up to next year's withdrawal of most international troops. Another 9 people were wounded in the bombing, and if any of those victims are left disabled by their injuries, they're likely to face an uncertain future. Afghanistan isn't an easy place to make a living, even if you're healthy, but for people with disabilities, it's an outright hostile environment. Tens of thousands of Afghans have been permanently maimed during decades of conflict. Jobs are scarce, and almost nothing in Afghan society is handicap accessible. So activists are demanding change. NPR's Sean Carberry reports.
Climbing this rickety metal staircase is precarious enough if you aren't on crutches, but it's simply dangerous if you are. At the top is the office of John Bazani Mahan. It's one of many social councils for disabled Afghans. Men missing arms, legs, or hands sit around the small room. Hussein Karimi is the head of the council. He lost a leg during the decade-long war against the Soviets in the 80s. He couldn't find work, so he started the council to help some of the more than 100,000 registered war-disabled Afghans. Among other services, the council helps provide vending carts to its 200 members. That way they can earn money rather than beg for it in the streets like countless amputees across Kabul. Haji Amarullah is 45. He lost his lower legs to a landmine during the Soviet war. Because he's uneducated, he couldn't find a desk job, and because of his prosthetic legs, no one would hire him for any unskilled work. Amarullah says he registered for the government stipend for those with war-related disabilities. The $350 annual salary is about what the typical Afghan makes in a month. And if you're one of the nearly 1 million Afghans the government says are disabled from birth or by an accident, you get no financial support. Until now, it's largely fallen on private NGOs like the Red Cross to care for the disabled. Here at their orthopedic center in Kabul, they make nearly 2,000 prosthetic limbs each year, and they provide thousands of physical therapy sessions a month. Najimuddin Halal is the head of the center and is himself disabled. He lost his legs to a landmine in the 80s. He says disabled Afghans face barriers everywhere they turn.
Even the private clinics, private hospital, they are not accessible.
And good luck finding elevators, ramps, or handicapped accessible bathrooms in Kabul. The Red Cross makes it a point to hire people like Halal. He says that Afghans are accepting of disabled people, but
they think they should be in a corner, just they are sorry for them, not let them to express their potential. There is not a feeling of the right of the disabled.
That's why hundreds of disabled Afghans took to the streets of Kabul last month. They were mostly aging Mujahideen fighters who limped and crutched their way towards the presidential palace to demand their rights. They carried coffins and called for the government to pass a law protecting the rights of the disabled. President Hamid Karzai agreed to hear their demands. Activist Mohammed Daoud Serre attended the meeting.
We have visited President Karzai 25 times, but this time he treated us very differently. The meeting had a very friendly environment.
He says Karzai was receptive to their list of demands, including seats in parliament, more health and education services, a higher stipend, and housing. Sayer says for now everything is on paper, but he says Karzai gave orders to the ministries to act.
We take it as a good sign and hope all our demands will be met.
But officials in the ministry responsible for the disabled say some of the demands would require constitutional changes or money the government simply doesn't have. And they know well the challenges ahead, as they're still struggling to get a working elevator in their office.
That's NPR's Sean Carberry in Kabul, Afghanistan. Coming up, forecasters say more tornadoes could hit the country's midsection today after violent storms ripped through Iowa, Kansas, and Oklahoma yesterday. The worst damage appears to be in the Shawnee, Oklahoma area, where one person was killed. Another 21 were injured throughout the state. We'll have the latest in 30 seconds here and now. The National Weather Service is predicting even more severe weather today from central Missouri to north Texas after weekend tornadoes tore through five states, killing two people and injuring 20. In Kansas, golf ball-sized hail was reported. Near Shawnee, Oklahoma, video showed flashes from electrical transformers blowing out. And in Edmond, Oklahoma, the Associated Press interviewed one man who thought he saw a flock of birds, but it was actually debris swirling around the street. Adam Kemp is a reporter for the Oklahoman. And Adam, we understand you've been driving around some of the back roads in Kearney, Oklahoma, one of the hardest hit areas. What have you been seeing?
Just basic utter devastation. There's just trees lying everywhere, homes completely flattened by this, you know, mild wide tornado that kind of came through here. Just people trying to rebuild is really all I'm seeing right now, trying to figure out where to start.
This is rural Oklahoma, and we've been reading that a lot of people live in these double-wide trailer homes, which are a little more sturdy than mobile homes, but not all that much. How did these double-wides hold up in these storms?
They don't, actually. They get completely blown away. I talked with people yesterday. I rolled up to their house, and, you know, all that was left was the front porch that was just left into the ground. Their mobile homes are getting taken away, really just scattered to the wind. If it can uproot like a 100-year-old pecan tree like it has in other places around Kearney, then these double-wides really don't stand a chance.
Uprooting trees, so obviously not just destructive but incredibly dangerous to have things like that flying around.
Definitely. There's debris everywhere. I actually just stumbled upon a mailbox that I found in the middle of a field, and I couldn't find a house within 500 yards of it. So it still had the big cement stone attached to the bottom of it, and it was just lying in the middle of a field, nowhere near a house. So kind of crazy, the power of a tornado.
Adam, you met a woman named Carolyn Bailey who was in the path of the tornado in her house. What happened to Carolyn?
I met Carolyn this morning. She told me about her and 20 other members of her family. They were just watching the news and decided to take cover in their storm cellar. They ended up getting trapped, basically, in their cellar just as their entire house fell in around them.
Were they unharmed?
Everyone was unharmed, but their house was totally gone.
And I'm sure that was terrifying.
Yeah, she said that, you know, it was just incredibly loud and scary. All her grandchildren were in there with her, and they were crying. But, you know, they're all safe. They'll remember that experience, and they'll know not to mess around when the tornado comes through.
What about disaster response? Are you seeing many emergency vehicles around yet, or is that process just beginning?
I saw everything as it happened last night. Even 30 minutes to an hour after the tornado ran through here, there were, you know, highway patrol, what looked like beginnings of the National Guard and Red Cross. It was pretty immediately called the disaster relief area, and Mary Fallon, our Oklahoma governor, pretty quickly got on that and got some national relief in here. So they were quick to respond, and they're out and about all over the place today, marking houses with white paint, trying to see what's damaged beyond repair and what might possibly be able to be fixed.
You know, today you have a situation where a lot of people are cleaning up from yesterday's tornado, but still have to keep an eye out for a possible additional tornado today. So what's the mood right now, would you say?
Cautious, I would say. Talking with just a couple people so far, they're trying to get what valuables can be salvaged out of their wrecked homes for the most part, and they're going to head it back to somewhere safe, either a family member's home or something like that, and start watching the weather all over again.
Adam Kemp is a reporter for The Oklahoman. Adam, stay safe, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Congress in a flurry of hearings, the White House scrambling to answer questions. That's Washington today, but it could just as easily have been 40 years ago.
If the many allegations made to this day are true, then the burglars who broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at Watergate were in effect breaking into the home of every citizen of the United States. And if these allegations proved to be true, what they were seeking to steal was not the jewels, money, or other property of American citizens, but something much more valuable, the right to vote in a free election.
That's Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina at the opening of the Senate Watergate hearings held this month in 1973. If you find yourself nostalgic for that kind of investigative journalism that led to the Watergate hearings, you can relive the Washington Post's investigation by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein in the recently released Watergate: The Video Game. It's available free online, and it's not entirely journalistically accurate. You play the game as Bob Woodward, following leads and making calls, but pretty soon Timothy Leary shows up with drugs, you get in a fistfight with Nixon, and things get even weirder at the end. In fact, because of that and some of the language, we don't recommend it for young gamers. Joining us to explain his game is Samuel Kim. He's usually a writer and creator of animated shows and shorts, but in this case, he's the programmer behind Watergate, the video game. Samuel, for modern-day gamers who grew up with high-tech graphics and elaborate dialogue, you know, World of Warcraft and Xbox, your game is not that. It's very, very retro with lots of pointing and clicking.
Yes, it uses an old interface from an old video game called Shadowgate, which was this point-and-click adventure game from the 1980s, in which probably the most impressive technical feat is that it has a still photograph of where you're standing to sort of show where you are. And a lot of it requires reading, so it's incredibly retro.
Walk us through, if you would, the opening scene of the game, where the person is playing Bob Woodward and you meet with Ben Bradley, the legendary editor of the Washington Post. Things get pretty wild pretty fast. I mean, swords get involved.
He walks into the Washington Post. He talks to Ben Bradley, who gives him sort of the scoop, although that's not entirely historically accurate. I think it was the police beat editor. But he gets the information from Bradley, and he receives a very special item that will help him on his adventure.
This is the sword.
Yeah, I didn't want to spoil it, but thank you for spoiling for everybody. It starts off as a pretty close adaptation of both the book and the film All the President's Men, and then it goes off the rails towards the second half. I guess all the video gamey violence that happens at the end of it is more of a spoof of the way the Watergate mythology is usually told, which is they uncover the story, and the following Thursday, the Nixon administration falls. There's much more to the story than that. So all that over-the-top stuff that happens later on in the game is sort of a spoof of that oversimplification.
What's also interesting about your game is that you can see what happens if Woodward decides not to pursue the mission to investigate Watergate.
You get to see sort of an alternate history of what happens if Woodward became a bloviating blogger, I guess. It was kind of interesting to be able to write that alternate history where you see what happens if Woodward wasn't as dogged in his approach toward pursuing the story. Because, you know, Watergate at the time was not a very popular story. In fact, most people at the time, according to the polling, never even heard of it or cared about it. That aspect of the gameplay was making sure that we pay due to his courage and his bravery.
Samuel Kim is a comedian, writer, and creator of Watergate, the video game. Samuel, thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to check out the game, we've got a link at hereandnow.org. Before we go today, tensions on Mount Everest. This is Here and Now. The Mount Everest climbing season is underway, and once again, crowds of climbers are flocking to the world's tallest mountain. Two climbers in their 80s hope to become the oldest men to reach the top. Over the weekend, a British climber got in trouble with Nepalese authorities for showing the first ever live images from the summit using his smartphone. He didn't have permission to do that. It's so different from May 29, 1953, the day 60 years ago when Edmund Hillary and his Nepalese mountaineer Tenzing Norgay became the first people known to make it to the summit. This year's season has already been marred by an ugly fight between Sherpa guides and Western climbers. Our next guest says he always holds his breath this time of year. Peter Athens has stood on the summit of Mount Everest 7 times. That makes him one of only 3 non-Sherpas to do that. He's also guided many expeditions there, and he helped rescue climbers during the deadly May 1996 climbing season, chronicled in the bestseller Into Thin Air. Pete is now a filmmaker and active promoter of Sherpa culture and literacy in Nepal, where he is now. We asked him why he thinks Everest is what he calls a powder keg at this time of year.
The tensions arise basically from the overcrowding on the route itself in dangerous, exposed places. There only can be a certain number of people who travel at any given time there, so people may have to wait at various times to either go up or come down. So that leads to further exposure in a high place. I mean, you can imagine what it's like to be waiting at the top of the Hillary Step at above 28,000 feet, and you have a team of 100 people who are moving up through to go to the summit. Now, if you're on your way down and you really want to get down because your oxygen equipment is low, then you're going to have, obviously, a lot of anxiety about that.
We mentioned this fight that broke out recently between some Sherpa guides and Western climbers. It had something to do with the climbing lines, and the Western climbers ended up claiming that the Sherpas tried to kill them, and it's left very bad feelings between these groups of people who have to rely on each other to make it back alive. What does that signal to you?
I think what it signals to me, Sasha, is that there may not have been the best understanding between the parties as to what was going to take place on any particular day. I know that in the past there has been a general accord with most of the teams in base camp that they'll decide a particular day that the Sherpas will go up and prepare the route. And the Sherpas asked if there could be no other climbers on the mountain at that particular time, just to make their lives a little easier and to have no one else actually putting themselves at risk. But apparently there were definitely some harsh words spoken either way. This is something that's quite unusual. We don't see this type of behavior on Everest that much. And if you're going over and climbing on Everest, you know, effectively you're an ambassador from your own country. And this is a place that sees hundreds of travelers this time of year. If you choose to and want to have ultimate liberty at high altitude and in extreme environments, there are a lot of other places you could choose to go.
Sherpas do very hard work. I mean, it's certainly very physically arduous work. And there was one Nepalese guide, a Sherpa, who told the New York Times recently that he feels that he and other Sherpas are doing more than they used to, and it seemed that was problematic for them. What are the additional demands being put on Sherpas?
I think that as time has given the Sherpa the opportunity to get better training, some of them are international mountain guides, some of them have trained both inside Nepal and outside Nepal and in the West in a variety of places. With that increased professionalism, there's also been, I think, the willingness to accept more responsibility. And with the greater commercialization of the mountain, there's more demands for those skills and for that professionalism. And generally, they accept it quite well, but there are certain flashpoints and, you know, obviously a lot of unintended consequences of this overcrowding and obviously of people not having any restraint.
We were wondering, Pete Athens, for someone like you who's been to Everest so many times over such a long period of time, what you feel about this increasing commercialization and such volumes of people to the point that there's gridlock. How do you feel about that?
I'm concerned that there's a lot of people that are being put at a great amount of risk, especially when we're seeing in recent years these summit windows a very compressed amount of time, you know, where we're seeing over the period of the month of May, early June, we're only seeing perhaps a week of days where it's actually possible to get there. With this route crowding, with the issues of timing, only having a limited number of resources to complete one's climb, it just puts the entire community there at an extreme amount of risk.
Pete, we mentioned earlier that you were part of a rescue effort on Everest. This was back in 1996, and you actually helped remove the body of a friend, Bruce Herod, from the mountain. I think 4 expeditions had climbed past his body. What was it like to go back to Everest after that? Did it change your thinking about the mountain in any way, make you have more respect or more fear?
I think I've always approached the mountain with a great amount of humility. I think what more I was concerned about and what I learned from 1996 was, even in spite of having such an example of events that took place, still people seemed to be lulled into a false sense of overconfidence, and that people like Bruce Herod, even after 8 people had died 2 weeks previous on the mountain, pushed himself to summit very, very late. When I found him, it was actually the following year, he was flipped upside down, hanging from a rope at about 28,000 feet.
His body had been there for a year?
His body had been there for a year. So, it just underscored the fact that, despite anything that we might learn, despite all the different attention that those events seemed to garner, I'm not sure people learned a lot.
More people keep going despite having seen what happened to people in the past?
Absolutely. You put out to the world that you're going to go on and take on this objective, and it's a huge amount of time away from family, from work. It's a large amount of money. It's a large amount of psychological energy, preparation physically. So sometimes getting to the top of the mountain is the most critical thing, and getting back down is the last thing on your mind.
Pete, for those of us who haven't been there and probably will never get there, what is it like physically up there on the summit?
Well, the summit itself is kind of like a ridge that's about 40, 50 feet long. It gently slopes away into a pyramid down three different sides. One doesn't have a huge sense of the perspective if it's really cloudy and one can only see out and up into the sky, but the quality of light is completely different. Obviously, you've looked outside of an aircraft. When you're flying above 30,000 feet, you just see that the light is very, very bright. It's almost surreal. And if you're lucky and blessed enough to be on top when there's a beautiful day, you just see the world spread out beneath you. You start to recognize some of the lower peaks that look almost insignificant by comparison to Everest that at one time looked really quite large. It's a remarkable experience.
It seems like this is a place you really love, and that in fact there's so much about all of Nepal and that area you love. I mean, we've read that you're involved in helping cataract patients in Nepal with eye care, with literacy issues, and bringing libraries, with exploring cave dwellings and archaeology. Is this sort of a love affair with the country at this point?
It's a love affair with the country. It's a love affair with the people and just the drama of the environment, the richness of the culture and the art. It's a wonderful country to go and visit for any number of reasons, whether it's to see the rooftop of the world or whether it's to meet some of the local artists, the Newars who settled the Kathmandu Valley more than 1,000 years ago.
I envy you for having been up there as many times as you have.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. It's an unusual, rarefied group that goes up there, and we're glad that people are interested in us.
Pete Athens is one of the world's foremost high-altitude mountaineers. He stood on the summit of Mount Everest 7 times. Pete, thank you.
My pleasure, Sasha. It's been a privilege.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Please join us again here and now to see what the rest of the week brings.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.